Well, I just came across this and remembered it from Pirkei Avot about do not engage in much conversation with your wife. I'm sure you get that.
Yes, this is a gem. This is really a gem. Al karda sicha im ha'isha. Listen carefully. Don't multiply, increase, make a lot. Sicha, conversation im ha'isha with a woman. First of all, the word sicha in Hebrew connotes pointless chatter. Pointless chatter. It's always contrasted to serious speech. For example, the Mishnah's Talmud says, even the sicha of a scholar needs study. We're not talking about his study, we're not talking about his teaching, we're not talking about his deciding. Even the sikha, his pointless chatter, needs study. Okay? Now, what does the Mishnah say? Don't multiply pointless chatter with a woman. Don't multiply. Which means that some pointless chatter is permissible. Just don't multiply it. Don't expand it. So actually what the Mishnah is telling you is, some pointless chatter with your wife is appropriate. It's appropriate. Just don't, you know, make a major project out of pointless chatter. And then, of course, certainly shouldn't do it with someone who isn't your wife, because then you're inviting problems. So, read appropriately, the Mishnah is telling you something which is, I would say, a leniency that's mildly surprising. Some pointless chatter with a woman is permissible. Unbelievable. Yeah? But you have to know what the word sicha means. Sicha means really pointless chatter. Okay? Who's noch?
Yeah. I wasn't here. I must mention it, but my parents have a boy in the book of the nature by a girl. It's not.
Yeah, the explanation goes like this. If you think of having a child, and you think of your investment in the child, and you think of the world's investment in the child, you see that the world's investment is the opposite to your investment. What does the world care more about, men or women, boys or girls? Girls. Because another boy does not add to the reproductive power of the group. A boy doesn't add any reproduction. A girl adds reproduction. Only women bear children. Right? A man can have many wives. So in a society with 60% women and 40% men, all the women can bear. In a society with 60% men and 40% women, you lose out because you have too few women to bear. So the world's investment is investment in girls, not boys. But my investment is in my grandchildren. Now, if I have a boy, or if I have a girl, which way will I have more grandchildren? Well, if I have a boy and he has two wives, I multiply my grandchildren. If I have a girl, the grandchildren will come from her and only from her. So I get more in terms of my family out of a boy than I get out of a girl. And that's what's being registered. That I get a benefit in a male child that I don't get from a female child. The commentators in the Gemara over there, Marsha, I think, points out that this is this competition between what the world wants and what the person himself wants. Yeah.
But monogamy was decreed 1,000 years ago and was still making blessings.
Well, monogamy was decreed. It wasn't decreed. It was a custom that came into existence, and Rabbeinu Gershom created a penalty for someone who will violate it. There's also a way to avoid it. There's a way to get around the monogamy decree. What happens in a case where a man wants to give a woman a gift and she refuses to accept it? A man cannot divorce his wife against her will. That's forbidden, but it's binding. So the way to get around it is to get what's called the Heter Meirabanim. You go around to 100 rabbis and get them all to agree that the sky is blue, which is hard enough. But all right, you got 100 rabbis to agree that your situation is desperate, and therefore they give you permission to marry a second wife. And then you are permissible, you cannot give her a divorce against the will. That you can never do. but you get permission to marry a second wife. Usually, under those conditions, the first wife gives up. But you get 100 rabbis to agree. You can imagine that's not going to happen very often. But so you see that prohibition against monogamy, against polygamy, is not binding. There's a way to get around it. And it was only codified by Rabbeinu Gershom, who represented the Ashkenazi world. It was never codified for the Sephardi world, and it's not binding on the Sephardi world. So under those conditions, the universal tradition of making the blessing under this condition or that was not effective. Yeah.
Does it matter if one of the Rebbeim you go to says no, and then you find 99 more that say yes?
I think you only, it's a very good question. I believe you need 900 to say yes.
The fact that
somebody
row?
Says no won't
all right. Won't,
but you have to find 100, all of whom will say yes. Yeah.
I'm wondering, all these arguments that we use to defend Judaism against the attacks of feminist groups, could you just make the exact same arguments for, say, Islamic treatment of women? Because many people look down upon the way women are treated in Muslim countries. And could one just make the same arguments?
I imagine you could. Here, you'll have to, in order to distinguish the cases, you'll have to go back to the major premises. Imagine someone who says, listen, you have a justice system. And in your justice system, sometimes you execute criminals. You are killing a person against his will. Murderers also kill people against his will. So what's the difference between what you're doing and murder? At this point, if all you look at is the fact that this guy is dying and doesn't want to die, there's no difference. You have to look at the major premise. Now, someone says, we have our beliefs and we have our traditions and so on and so on. If the beliefs and traditions are not based on anything real, if they're not based on the evidence, so then you can say, look, you have made up a tradition, and that tradition disadvantages people. The whole thing is rotten. Then you have to go back to the major premises and ask what reason is there to accept that. But in terms of the logic below it, indeed, I don't think you can criticize it. I agree.
Also wasn't clear that you mentioned about a woman not being able to be a bear witness.
Yes, I spoke about that.
And did you mention the source, and did you connect it with their emotional faculties?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That's not connected with their emotional faculties. Can't be. Because their credibility to establish fact is not in question. Their credibility to establish fact is not in question. They are as acceptable to establish fact as men are. There's a special function of testimony in Jewish law to mandate court action, and that is the only place where they are invalid. But to establish fact, their statement is just as acceptable as a man's statement. So if we're an emotional problem, that wouldn't be true. And this is in Meiselman's book. You can read the chapter on this. Yeah.
Well, in the overall picture, every case, man is coming out first place, woman's coming out second place.
And
there's always a special reason. But they're always coming out with the gold medal. And,
This is reminiscent to the following feeling. There are all these objections. Now, it's true you have answers to each objection, but isn't there something rotten when there are so many objections? I would ask you to think of parallels. What would you do when you face an anti-Semite? He has 100 complaints against Jews. You have answers to all of them. Now somebody says, okay, I know, you can answer each one. But isn't there something rotten that they have all these complaints against you? There's got to be something wrong there. What would you say? No, absolutely not. It's simply not true. As a matter of fact, these people are prejudiced, and that's why every one of their complaints has an answer. Adarabha, when complaint after complaint has an answer, you have to begin to suspect that the person making the complaint has an agenda. Not that there's something really wrong with the thing that's being complained against, but the person making the complaint is suffering some kind of incompetence. Now, you say, they're really coming out first, but with a reason that we're not really coming out first. So then we're not really coming out first. So then the only thing that's left is, well, you've answered up all these complaints, there's so many complaints. I say, the more complaints you answer, the more it discredits the other side. As I said at the original, if men and women equally achieve prophecy, and prophecy is the highest spiritual achievement, then it can't be that in Jewish terms, women are being disadvantaged. You'll tell me that in terms of New York values, they're being disadvantaged? Of course, what do you expect? Jewish practice was not instituted in order to satisfy New York values. It was instituted to satisfy Jewish values. The only valid criticism, it's another point that Meisner made to me many years ago, it's a very acute point. The only valid criticism of a system is to show that for the values of the system, someone doesn't get a fair shake at achieving those values. The minute you step outside the system and use external values, the challenge will be, what makes your values any more valid than the values of the system itself? If you use your values to criticize the system, at most what you're saying is, I, with my values, wouldn't buy into such a system. That's not surprising. The system's based on values different from yours. But that's no critique of the system. That's just your statement that you're different. That's not a claim of discrimination. The communists used to do this. They used to say, this group of people is being victimized. And when they tell you they're not, they're guilty of false consciousness. They themselves don't know that they're being victimized. They've been convinced to understand that they're not being victimized and they're really being victimized. In other words, we know they're being victimized, though they don't. And therefore, we're representing their true interests, even though they don't know that they're in trouble. That's pretty audacious, I would say, to say, I know better than you that you're a victim. You don't realize you're a victim, and I'm representing the interest that you say you don't have. At that point, I think we should settle a person to, you know, take a walk. Who are you to tell me that I'm not getting what I want? They don't say it anymore. Mostly. Yeah? Everybody's happy? Yeah.
This is more of a question of logic. You said earlier that there's not just women alone, but there's other groups of people that are discredited from testimony. So, and you concluded from this that because all these other groups are not discredited due to their lack of intelligence or lack of
trustworthiness,
therefore women cannot be included in that group. Doesn't that assume that all the parties involved have a similar reason for not being included in the testimony? Can you say that each one is individually?
You certainly can. You certainly can. But what's been forgotten here is the way the dialectic starts. They are starting with a claim. The claim is women are excluded, and they claim they have an explanation. Now, I say that their explanation is without foundation. Doesn't mean it's not true. It just means it's without foundation. Because you have this exclusion and four other exclusions. The four others clearly have nothing to do with intelligence or trustworthiness. Therefore, you cannot infer, if you're inferring, you cannot infer that this one alone is due to lack of trustworthiness or intelligence. Might be true, but you have no reason for inferring it. They're putting it forward as the true explanation. I say you have no foundation whatsoever to assert that explanation. Right? That's all I want. It's without foundation. I'm not proving that it's false. I don't bear the burden of proof here. They do. They say they have an explanation. I'm saying that there's no reason to accept it. Yeah.
So, if I create a system that starts with a major premise and flows logically from that major premise, but my system involves, like, women always crawling around in circles or something silly like that, but it flows from the logical major premise, so you're saying that, like, you have to attack it within the system and not look at the system related to other systems, which is valid, but what if, like, how do you judge the system objectively as a whole if in some objective way women aren't being, forget women, but anybody's not being treated properly?
Well, first of all, we're talking now about a society that accepts the system, including these ones who are crawling around on the floor. And they all accept it. Someone from the outside is saying that these people are being disadvantaged. You ask the people inside, and then they don't agree with you. They say everything's fine. People outside say they're really being disadvantaged. Now, at that point, I say, you're an outsider, you're not part of it, and you don't share the values. So what you're really saying is, this system doesn't fulfill my values. Okay, it doesn't. It wasn't designed to, and in fact it doesn't. That's not a big surprise. But why would that be a charge of discrimination for these people when their values are ones which are being satisfied by the way the system is structured? Unless you can argue in some way that your values are superior. Now, if there is a case of clear suffering with no advantage, or the advantage has no foundation in logic or foundation in evidence, then one might attempt a critique from the outside. And that's what I said in answer to his question about Islam. Whoever asked me about Islam here. Right? There I would say, yes, you have a system with principles, and the principles create these consequences. But if the principles themselves are not based on any evidence whatsoever, if they're just made up, then we have to ask why they should be accepted and why they should be enforced. Right? So then you can bring a critique. But the critique will be based on evidence. Evidence for the truth of the principles. Direct critique of values is much more difficult, though I believe it can be done in some cases, but it's much more difficult and much more controversial. If you can show that the factual premises are without foundation, so then you're in much better shape in terms of undermining a system from the outside. To argue against values directly, as I said, it's controversial. I believe it can be done. But if someone fought with me and said, look, there are those who disagree, I would have to do that.
Typically, the people who are attacking our system are the same people that say that no values are better than others in the first place. They're relativists anyway, so that would be a pretty ironic thing for them to complain.
It's not only ironic, it's self-contradictory, and this self-contradiction runs throughout the critique. It's and it is kind of logical blindness that affects people across the board. You have people, many people. Okay, a lot of them are students, so they don't really count. But you even have professors and journalists and politicians who will tell you, in the same breath, that all values are relative and that they believe in universal human rights.
Sure.
Try pushing a person. Do you believe in universal human rights? Yes. Now, do you believe the values are absolute? No. Isn't there a contradiction there? Yes, there's a contradiction there. What motivates it? What motivates it is, get off my back. Don't tell me what to do. So on the one hand, if I have rights, you can't push me beyond my rights. On the other hand, you try to tell me what's right and wrong, I tell you, values are relative. There's just two ways of getting people off my back. Of course, they can definitely contradict one another. If I don't believe in universal rights, then why am I plumping for, if I don't believe in objective values, why am I plumping for universal human rights? Why should there be universal? That dictator of Indonesia, Suharto, 10 years ago said, why are you people in Chicago exporting your rights to us? We don't need them. We're not part of your culture. We're not part of your society. Leave us alone. And indeed, from the point of view of those who are relativists or multiculturalists, he had a very good point. How can you be a multiculturalist and then tell other cultures what to do?
Yeah, of course.
The point was interesting. You point out contradictory logical thinking. And what's wrong with these people? They must be meshuggah. And the thing is they're not. Actually, they're doing something very rational. And that is, they're just putting forward good propaganda.
Correct. Correct. That's correct. And people they're talking to...
Walter Lippmann's book on propaganda. This is classic.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. And you're counting on the fact that the audience is going to be swayed by the emotional basis of your position, and not the basis of logic. And they're not going to think logically either, so you can manipulate them that way. That's 100% correct.
It's genius, because people see what they're saying is in my best interest. If they see this is my best interest, then your system of values gets promulgated and becomes the system.
Yeah, I think
right.
That's
the way I would go.
It's 100% correct. I mentioned the business. Were you there when I mentioned the Maccabi Games?
I played for Maccabi Soccer League. I was like four.
Oh, okay. So look at this. Talk about propaganda. The Maccabees fought against the Assyrian Greeks. They fought against Greek culture. Now, the Greeks invented international athletic competition. That's one of the things they invented. Today, you have international athletic competition in Israel, and it's called the Maccabi Games. Isn't that brilliant? There's propaganda with a capital P, right? Because you're taking the word Maccabi from the people who oppose Greek culture and putting it as a label on the contemporary expression of Greek culture.
And those games are so devoid of anything Jewish.
Of course, it's Greek, it's not Jewish.
They're not looking at it from a historical point of view. They're looking at it in terms of secular Zionist revisionism, which is those are the people we identify with as strong Jews, so we're going to use that as our label for something that allows us to be like the Goyim.
So your first sentence is not correct. They definitely are looking at it from a historical point of view. Only they're falsifying the history. If they weren't looking at it from a historical point of view, they wouldn't use the historical Jewish name.
But historical already implies a certain degree of accuracy and truth. And how can you use that in the same sentence?
Then split it. They definitely are using a historical name, and it's a Jewish name. You won't find Maccabee in any other country in the world.
But
not even Maccabee beer, like we have in this country, right?
Right.
So it's definitely an attempt to link with a Jewish historical factor, but they do it via a lie, because there's no other way for them to do it. They can't link with Jewish history any other way.
It's a good idea if you see something in someone else's culture and you co-opt it into your own culture and you don't benefit. Why not? I mean, every day we use Greek logic, Aristotelian thinking and understanding. Hey, if it works, let's use it, but let's make it a Jewish thing.
No. But here we're talking about two different things. When in the 60s, when meditation from India was adopted in America as the panacea for all sorts of problems, but it was meditation and was advertised as coming from India, and there were gurus from India who were teaching people how to do it. So there was no falsification involved. No falsification involved. They were simply adopting it. I agree with you. Cultures definitely have benefit from borrowing from one another. But just imagine that someone would come back from the East and then write a false diary of Thomas Jefferson and say, look what I discovered. Thomas Jefferson used to meditate. Meditation is a mainstream American practice. Let's all do it as good Americans. That's a lie. That's what's going on here. You borrow an item and you lie about it and assimilate it into your culture. That's another matter. Then you're falsifying. That's really propaganda as well. Yeah.
I think the whole idea of relative values, like, you can't really judge someone unless you're taking the viewpoint of the people who are practicing where they're from. So couldn't you argue that some things are just like universally, like you said, universal values as opposed to relative values? So like 100 years ago, didn't the majority of women all agree that they shouldn't be voting? And then today, women, it's unthinkable that a woman wouldn't be able to vote. So at the time, relatively, it was acceptable that women would be able to vote, and therefore we can conclude that for them it was an okay thing. But isn't that kind of a difficult thing to accept?
You're opening up a whole Pandora's box here. There are about 7 distinctions that have to be made carefully, and you have to keep your head straight on, screwed on straight most of the time. Look, don't confuse relativity of circumstances with relativity of values. On which side of the road is the correct to drive? Well, that's relative. Because in England, the answer is, in America, the answer is right, and in England, the answer is wrong. I mean, it's left.
You read the first one.
Yeah. Right. So now, the correct side of the street of which to drive is relative to the circumstances. This is not relative values. This is relative to circumstances. This person is asking for charity. Should I give him or not? It depends upon whether he's really needy or whether he's a charlatan. Is that relative values? No. Needy people should get, and charlatans shouldn't get. So obviously, what you do is going to be determined by the circumstances in which you find yourself. That doesn't mean your values are relative. Now, let's take the case where values change. Speak now from the point of view, let's say, of secular society. Let's take slavery. Is the attitude 150 years ago in the United States, in the southern United States, slavery was perfectly acceptable. So in that case, it was perfectly all right. And now we've changed our minds. So like fashions, slavery went out of fashion. Is that the way people look at it? Definitely not. They look at it as a moral advance. We are more moral, more just than they were then. So we don't say that when it was acceptable, it was, when people did it and agreed to it, it was morally acceptable. We say it was wrong, and they were morally short-sighted or selfish or handicapped one way or another, and we now know better. No one is going to say that if there's a new movement in favor of slavery, you say, well, when it gains enough adherence and people come to regard it as okay, then it will be okay. Just have to see what the outcome will be. Will they go over the 50% mark? Or they won't go over the 50% mark. No one will say that. It's not Parisian fashions. We're talking about morality. So the fact that something was acceptable and now is not acceptable doesn't imply the morality is relative. Only if you go on to conclude that when it was acceptable, it was really okay. But that people will deny.
How do you apply then the new movements that say like women are allowed to read from the Torah and responsibility and all that, and then conclude that they're just now more morally advanced compared to the...
Because this has nothing to do, this has nothing to do with judgments of morality. This has to do with relating to the creator of the universe. So now here you come to a fork in the road. What do they claim? Do they claim that they are serving the creator of the universe better, or do they claim that it's more equal and they're getting more rights? Which are they claiming? If they're claiming it's more equal and they're getting more rights, they're correct. It is more equal and it is more rights, and it has nothing to do with God. And they created a little club, or a large club, and in that club they do whatever they please, and they can answer to whatever intuitions or whatever principles appeal to them. That's not in conflict with us. They're not playing the same game by the same rules. They decided to do something else. It's a free world, and they'll get away with it. But if they claim that they're serving God better, then I want to know, where did God say so? God is a reality. God is as real as this table. You can't make the table over because you wish it were something else. The table has to tell you what it is. You're serving God. Tell me where God said that this is appropriate. If he didn't say so, then it's fantasy world. Yeah.
So, coming from the conservative movement, I can give you one of the points of view I heard on this. So, women like the Silwan or even the Torah, they said they're excluded from having to engage in any of the positive science-based misspoke. If they come to the shul and they want to come out with the Silwan or whatever, it's optional. They don't have to. They want to. Fine. It's not that they're serving God any better or worse. They get credit for doing the optional miss, as long as it's not in exclusion for doing something that's an obligation.
He missed the first talk.
Well, it's okay. No. It doesn't matter. No, what he said so far is correct. What he said so far is correct, because it is true. First of all, by the way, just to set the facts straight, about half of the time-bound positive commandments women are obligated in. Kiddush Friday night, and the whole Seder, and...
But there's some they're not.
Okay. Right. So now, it is true, the general rule is, those commandments in which they're not obligated, they're invited to do them, and many women, and I would say the majority, or even universally, women in the Frum community, in the Haredi community, do them. Every woman listens to Shofar Rosh Hashanah, even though she's not obligated. Every woman takes the lulav and esrog, even though she's not obligated. Right? Still, in these communities, women don't wear tefillin and they don't put on a talus. So already, there ought to be a question in a person's mind. Now, here's the answer. In case of tefillin, this all is in my Zimun's book. In the case of tefillin,
very well in that book, right?
Look, it's a classic, and as I said, and I would say this to anyone, a person who hasn't read this book has no right to an opinion. You don't get the right to opinion because you can talk. You get the right. You have to earn the right to an opinion because you studied something. Anyway, he says like this: the mitzvah of tefillin has two layers. There's an obligation, the absolute obligation. The absolute obligation is about 5 minutes. If you put on tefillin 5 minutes for the day, no one can claim that you broke the law. But the mitzvah continues all day. The more you wear it, the more you've done. And indeed, if you're wearing them in the daytime, you can continue to wear them into the nighttime. And it was customary centuries ago that men wore tefillin all day, morning to night. Indeed, there still are certain small communities where it's done even today. But 97% of men do not do that. Why not? If it is a mitzvah to wear all day, not absolute obligation, but is a mitzvah to wear it all day, how come men don't do that? Indeed, the Rosh says it can't be forbidden to fall asleep wearing tefillin, to sort of drowse off, nod off, because since you're wearing tefillin all day long, surely the average person from time to time will nod off. And since that's taken into account, it can't be forbidden, because people are wearing them all day long. The Rosh is 800 years ago. But the rules of tefillin include a necessity for a certain cleanliness of body and a certain purity of thought. And we feel that we are not capable of that kind of focus, and therefore we wear tefillin only when we're davening, because we feel that when we're davening we do have that focus, and after that we can't take responsibility. So the men have restricted their mitzvah of tefillin because of that fear, even though for them it's obligatory. But they do more or less the minimum that's obligatory, and then they leave the rest go. For women, it's not obligatory at all. I don't think we presume that women are going to be easier to focus their thoughts, their control of their bodies more than men. So therefore, why should a woman engage in an action which is fraught with danger of violation if she has no obligation to do it? That's the reason why women don't wear tefillin.
This doesn't sound like an extraordinarily strong... it sounds like a... here's a good suggestion, right? This may be a good idea, but it's definitely not something that's... This is not like a heavy... I'm not going to throw a fumash at you and say, no, you've broken every rule in this.
You haven't, but you are... acting in a way that shows...
You can put something at risk.
That's right. And now the question will be, why are you putting this at risk? If the activity that you're doing it for is not a necessary activity.
And they could argue back and say, well, the men are trying to minimize the risk, but still there's a risk. Yet they do it, and this is why... You know, in the bracha, you can say before putting on the tefillin, I intend to fulfill this mitzvah correctly. So even if you put on the tefillin slightly wrong, or slight imperfection, you're still somewhat covered. So...
No, sorry, that's simply not true. We're talking about a violation now. Your intention is not to violate, don't mitigate.
So
how does that help?
I would assume that a woman putting on the tefillin, for example, is not intending to violate the mitzvah in any way.
Well, that's true, but you are responsible for things that are unintended if they're foreseeable in all of life.
They're foreseeable. Yes.
We don't believe in the double effect doctrine of the Catholics, where if I know it's going to happen, but I didn't intend it, I'm not responsible.
Right.
If you know it's going to happen, you're responsible for it.
Right. But let's say a woman who is at the Beit Knesset has made every precaution that she's ritually pure and in the same mindset that she's going to daven with the tefillin, and the minute she's done davening, maybe that mindset that the tefillin come off. Is she permitted to put on the tefillin?
So the question is, why is she risking something when she's not fulfilling an obligation? What justifies her making the risk when she doesn't have the obligation in the first place?
Because she feels like that she can reach a higher spiritual level.
So here's where the key question will be, is the determinant of the action what you feel like, or is the determinant of the action what the Torah defines as the legal value? And then that's the same parting of the roads that I said before. It's right, it's equality, it's something that appeals to me, I feel strongly about it. Like a shah, you're setting up your own club with your own rules. But nowhere do we base our rules on the fact that I feel more spiritual that way. I would certainly feel more spiritual if I brought my sacrifice to the temple and I carried out the sacrificial act. It's my sacrifice, it's my dedication to God. And the Kohen says, goodbye, go home, you are not needed here anymore. Okay, so now I say that this person is not only 7 years old, then he or she knows how to reason with things that are not explicit. And things that are just dangerous, and not things that are necessarily going to cause a problem. Does she wear seatbelts in her car? She doesn't know if she's going to have an accident. It's only possible, but you take a precaution. Does she recommend people not smoke? There's no proof that everybody who smokes is going to get sick. But you say, why take the danger? Why take the risk if you're not getting a benefit from it?
So your whole point is, so when a man puts on the tefillin, there's this much danger, right? It's a little danger, right?
Yeah.
Small amounts. Okay, and if a woman lays the tefillin, and she doesn't have, there's maybe a little more danger, and she doesn't have to deliver...
No, that's not the point. No, that's... I'm sorry, that's not the point. The point is not there's more danger. The amount of danger is the same.
It's irrelevant. You're saying the danger is the same, it's just she doesn't have to do it, so why bother taking the risk?
Correct! Exactly right. Why take the risk when there's no benefit in taking the risk? Here a man has to do it. He has no choice. So he minimizes the risk. But he's got to do it. He can't get away without it. Yeah. And as far as Talis is concerned, but this is quite interesting. We talked about obligatory and voluntary mitzvahs. What is the status of a Talis? Nowhere does the Torah say you have to put on a four-cornered garment. You want to wear round garments? Like a shawl, you'll never wear tzitzis. There's no commandment to put on strings or garments with strings. The mitzvah is, if you happen to put on a four-cornered garment, then it has to have strings, if you happen to do that. But you don't have to do that. There was a time when the average garment was just a rectangular piece of cloth with a hole in the center, put your head in the hole, the thing drapes around you, tie a belt, and that was your garment. So everybody wore tzitzis because that was the garment that they had. But if you have some other kind of garment that doesn't have those things, then you don't put on any tzitzis. It's become customary to wear such garments and to obligate ourselves in the mitzvah. The whole mitzvah of putting on tzitzis is voluntary. Now, for a woman, she can put on the four karmic garments and not put on tzitzis. So for a woman, it's doubly voluntary. She doesn't have to put on the garment. If she puts on the garment, she doesn't have to put on the tzitzis. So in terms of centrality and peripheral, this is the periphery of the periphery. It's as far out as you can go in terms of being optional. Right? So now one wants to know, why would a person invest in such an extraordinarily peripheral mitzvah? Has the person paid attention to the mitzvahs that are really obligatory? Does the person even care about the mitzvahs that are obligatory? Has the person invested in studying and making the effort to fulfill all the mitzvahs that are obligatory? There's a failure of priorities here for a person to invest in a doubly optional mitzvah when Shabbos and Kashrus and the laws of speech and charity and all the rest are somehow put on the side as unimportant. And the same critique is raised of men who will wear Rashi's tefillin and will also invest in Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, because Rabbeinu Tam had a different view about certain aspects of the tefillin, even though we have decided that Rashi's tefillin are the ones that are really binding. And the same critique that Shulchan Aruch says, a man who does that, you have to ask him, what are you doing? You are spending money and time and effort on a mitzvah that's really peripheral for a slightly different reason, but peripheral, even less peripheral than tzitzis for a woman. Why are you doing that? What about all the mitzvahs that you're really obligated in? It's called Mechzeki Yehora. It appears as a kind of religious pride. You know, I'm so perfect. I'm so far in. I'm so competent that I can even care about the very subtle nuances that are way out on the periphery. If that isn't true of the person, then he's doing something that's inappropriate. And this is said about men. So here it's going to apply about women in spades. That's why women typically didn't do that, even though you cannot say it's forbidden. But you know, not everything has to be forbidden with a club. A person, if you greet me in the morning and say, hello, how are you? And I say, fine, and walk away, it's not forbidden. They won't put you in jail. But we say it's insensitive. There's the question of religious sensitivity as well. By the way, I don't know if you were here when I made this point, maybe there were some others, and this is a very important point to register. There are some people, I should say this for the whole group, but you hear so much. If I repeat something, then maybe it'll stick. You hear groups of people, especially in the conservative or the conservadox movement, who say, I want to do X. Show me where it's forbidden. If it's forbidden, I won't do it. I believe in the rule book. Show me where it's forbidden. If you can't show me where it's forbidden, then it's not forbidden, and then I can certainly do it. The Chazon Ish described this idea as the principle of 613 obstacles. There are 613 obstacles. Now, if I can just steer in between the mitzvahs, just avoid all of them so that I don't get clubbed on the way to the goal, so then I can make it all the way through, and I can do as I please. If I put it this way, you see right away the invalidity of it. The mitzvahs are your opportunities to connect up to God. You do not justify action by showing it's not forbidden. You justify action by showing which mitzvah you're fulfilling. Show me which mitzvah you're fulfilling in doing this. Otherwise, if you steered clear of all the mitzvahs, you have something which is disconnected from God altogether. So God didn't say, I'll put you in jail if you do it. But it's still disconnected. That's no justification for doing it. The whole mental set, prove it's us, or prove it's wrong, is the wrong mental set. The burden of proof should be on them to show that they're fulfilling some mitzvah by so doing. And that will be difficult, I think.
That's actually the more interesting point, because you're changing the nature of the argument from prohibition and forbidden to a more positive spin, which is one of
fulfillment.
Fulfillment, yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So which is interesting, because you can say, I daven the conservative shul, right? So if I look at the correct liturgy, put on the whole bit, is just as much of a mitzvah as if I daven in the most charedi shul on the planet. Is that a correct statement?
Not really, but not for any reasons that we've discussed so far. Why?
It's a much more complicated discussion.
It's much more complicated. If you mean you're not using a conservative synagogue? As a conservative sitter?
That's an excellent question.
Because you use a conservative sitter, then they've changed liturgy in ways that are unacceptable.
That's an interesting question. Okay.
They've taken out the prayers for rebuilding the temple.
Those are in there.
The conservative Silberman says that.
The conservative movement is weird. You know
this.
They're weird. I enjoy it very much because the conservative synagogue I tend to go to doesn't feel very conservative because like all the prayers and all that stuff's all in there and we got in with all these guys.
What's it? What's it? You use?
Birnbaum.
I use the Birnbaum. Okay, very good.
That's all good.
Very good. Yeah.
I'm confused.
Do they have a machitza?
They don't need one. There's no women davening in the area.
Then there may be nothing wrong with it. The problem is mechitza. The problem is the separation between women and men in the synagogue. Without that, it's a real problem to daven there. But if there are only men davening there?
This is really going to confuse you. There's two minyans. One is all male, then it's in a separate building, there's another building where it's men's.
Yeah.
There's a wall between them, two walls actually, going to be technical.
So if you dive into the all males, then it's just a question of associating with a movement that's over the top. It's much more abstract, much more ethereal.
Very complex.
Yeah.
Okay, so now you can see why it's confusing.
Yeah.
Just wanted to get back to the spilling explanation you gave. I've heard, I don't know, you correct me if I'm wrong, I've heard that the reason that women don't wear tefillin is because tefillin is meant to put men on a higher spiritual level, and women are naturally on this higher spiritual level, and therefore they don't need it. And the proof of this is that on Shabbat you don't wear tefillin because you're already on that higher spiritual level.
That's beautiful. And what's being confused here is two different nuances of law. One is to be relieved of an obligation, and the other is to be prohibited. What you're really explaining is why they're relieved of the obligation. That would not explain why it's prohibited. You follow me? If you're on a higher spiritual level, you don't need these things. It doesn't follow that you're forbidden to do them.
But being outside of it, is it still true, though?
That's the reason why it's forbidden? There's no logic there whatsoever. Why should it be forbidden?
No, in terms of it's not obligatory.
Okay, so now, Rav Hirsch actually talks about this. I would urge you to avoid blanket statements. They're on a higher spiritual level. That's certainly not true. It's also not true that they're on a lower spiritual level. What's true is that it's apples and oranges. That there are many different facets of spirituality, and in some they're probably higher, and some they're probably lower, and it's impossible to sum it up and say, this one's higher than that one. Well, Hirsch does point out that the positive time-bound commandments, from which they are exempt, are symbolic. They're symbolic. That is to say, the commandment in and of itself, at least on the surface, without going into Kabbalah, and the surface doesn't do anything. So you wore black leather boxes with parchment inside. So what? Ah, but they symbolize certain ideas. And the Torah says about these that they are designed in order to that you should remember. Remember the commandments, remember the mitzvot, remember the laws. It says this about tefillin, and it says about tzitzis, both of them. Now, Rav Hirsch says, to whom do you command symbolic performances that are designed to remind you of things? To people who are likely to forget them. And that's why they need symbolic reminders. Somebody else whom you don't command symbolic remembrances are people who probably aren't likely to forget them. So he suggests that that could be an explanation for why these symbolic actions are commanded to men and not commanded to women. But that wouldn't be because they're on a higher spiritual level. It's a more local, narrowly defined idea. They're not likely to forget these things under these conditions, and therefore they don't need those reminders. Okay? That's not taking the Kabbalah into account, but at least on the surface, when you look at what the mitzvahs do, as far as we can see what they do, this is their function, and if you relieve somebody of that function, then it means that they don't need it. In general, that's what it means. When you have commandments that applies to one and not applies to another, it means the one to whom it doesn't apply doesn't need that commandment in order to fulfill their spirituality. I didn't get a chance to say it downstairs, but in terms of the intellectual versus the physical, let's take this coin. Now, the coin, on the average, spends 4 weeks a year, two-week sessions a year in the temple. And as I said, he's slaughtering animals and catching the blood and he's flaying animals over the sword. Now let's suppose that this Kohen is a scholar. It could happen by accident. The Kohen could also be a scholar. Should he regret his weeks in the temple? Because I'm not studying. I'm not publishing new results. I'm not making new analyses. I don't think so. Because the only purpose in studying is because God said so. And God also said to him that he should do this. Why should he regret doing it? That's what God wants of him. That will be the difference between our attitude and the Greek attitude. The Greek attitude, if you're butchering animals, you're wasting your time. If you're thinking, then you're accomplishing something great. For us, if you're serving God, you're accomplishing something great in any way that he wants to be served. All right? Leave you with a little thought. We say a woman and a man who live together appropriately, the name of God dwells among them. This is based on the fact that the word Ish is spelled Aleph Yud Shin, and the word Isha is spelled Aleph Shin Hey. So both words have the Aleph Shin. The man has a Yud, and the woman has a Hey. The Yud and the Hey together spell one of God's names. So if they dwell together appropriately, they each contribute a letter to God's name, and together God's name is formed. You take out the letters, take out the letters of God's name, you're left with Eish. Eish means fire. And that's what you get. You get fire. Those are the only two choices. By the way, the Talmud tells the following story. A Roman matron asked one of the Tanoim, since the creation, what has your God been doing? See, you know, 6 days he created everything, because he went on vacation. Okay, so he's not going to explain to her continuous creation and so forth and so on. That's too complicated for her. Says to her, he's been making matches. Matches between, you know, husband and wife. She said, that's what he's been doing? Pah, that's ridiculous. Anybody could do that. She had 1,000 slaves. She said 500 men, 500 women. Pair them up and send them home. Says, see, nothing to it. Next day, they came back. This one had a busted nose, and that one had a broken arm, and that one's black and blue all over, and they were fighting and screaming and yelling at it. She said, oh, look at that. Look at that. Maybe he is doing something. You know, this is so simple. What's the point of the story? The point of the story is that for a man and a woman to live together and to form a unit is unnatural. It's unnatural. They are so different, and their attitudes are so different, their perceptions are so different. It's an unnatural thing to do, to form a unity out of these two things. It needs a special kind of glue. It needs a special kind of glue. That glue is spirituality. Jewish spirituality, which is rooted in the way they're really created, rooted in the providence of God. Without that, it really isn't a natural thing to happen. So this sense that it ought to be is built in, but the type of glue that's required, if it isn't there, it leads to all sorts of aberrations, like what happened in Greece and Rome, and what happens in other cultures. By the way, there's a book called The Construction of Homosexuality. I almost forget the guy's name who wrote it. He's a professor at NYU. It was published by the University of Chicago Press about 10 years ago. And he researched, can I say it, all ancient cultures. He has 100 pages of references in this book. 100 pages of references. And he says every ancient culture practiced homosexuality in one form or another except Judaism. Either the priest did it, or the poor did it, or they did it on every other Saturday, or whatever it was. They all practiced homosexuality except Judaism. Someone who thinks that making room for homosexuality is a kind of modern, advanced, new innovation, it's a throwback to pagan and barbarian times. Greenberg. The guy's name is Greenberg. That's a symptom of the fact that the glue isn't there, that you have these kinds of aberrations. Okay.
Thank you.
What does it use for storage?
Huh?
What does it use for storage? I'm just curious.
Is it the
hexagon?
Oh.